Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. For many years, Anne Lamott has been a homespun Marin icon. Her books present her learning about life in ways both matter-of-fact and beautiful. A trip with her ailing father way out on the shimmering flats of a low tide. Mortality catching up with a triathlete friend. Her later-in-life love's bloom. At a time when so few people seem to want to talk about the universals of life, Lamott is all about love and death, suffering and God. We'll talk about the shock of time, that attic of stuff filled with memories even you can't remember, and the weight of shame. That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Anne Lamott's new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love, is her 20th book, probably destined to become a bestseller like many of the others. Her most famous book might be Bird by Bird, a work that's become a fixture of creative writing, both in official classes and for anyone just trying to get some words down on paper. And so we thought we'd give you a little writing prompt. And since this new book is about love, here it is. Listeners, tell us about a place that makes you feel love and why. Write it up. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Tell us about a place that makes you feel love and why. And we'll read some of your submissions with Anne Lamott during the hour. So Lamott's new work is a series of meditations on different kinds of love, the strange ways that it shows up in our lives, the different dimensions of its pleasures and pain. And along the way, we get to know Lamott herself at this stage of her life. This is Lamott's description of a dying friend, but it could serve as one for her too, perhaps. Every human thing about her is exposed. Her longing to live, her powerlessness, her passionate love of her kids and grandkids and a few friends. And by bringing such honest reflection forward, maybe we can all see ourselves a little more clearly. Thank you for that, Anne Lamott, and welcome back to Forum.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I really can't express in words what Forum means to me. It's my, you know, local girl makes old. Local girl. I'm still in my 60s, though, but only for 12 more hours.
I know. Happy 70. Early birthday.
I know. Huh?
What are you going to do to celebrate?
Well, I'm going to be on stage at the Symphony Space in New York City tomorrow night with and a few old friends are there. My husband's traveling with me, my publishing house, and there's a cake that I was on the Today Show this morning, and there's a cake studded individually with maybe 300 or 400 M&Ms that they're I've written about M&M communions before that when you're really down and out and someone hands you a few M&Ms, it usually restores you back to balance and sanity. So that's all I know at this point.
Wow. Well, that sounds pretty good. I mean, did you imagine that you'd reach 70, or is it kind of a shock?
You know, I wrote in somehow that I didn't think I'd see 18 because I was already drinking and using and crazy and driving. Mm. And then in my 20s, I was living in Bolinas and taking a lot of acid and meth and driving. My uncle Millard had given me his 1964 Chevelle Malibu station wagon, and I was driving. I used to drive carloads of people around when we took acid, and I mean just crazy stuff like that. I got sober almost 38 years ago, but even so, I didn't know how long I would live, because by a certain age, and I'm sure this is true for you, people your own age and younger are dying, and I think that's when you start getting serious about life, is when you realize that we're all on borrowed time. My best friend, who I've written a lot about, Pammy, died when she was 37. I wrote a book called Operating Instructions, which was about my son's first year, but it was also about her suddenly. I mean, I'd known her since I was under 10, you know, and we've been together, and she got sick and died, leaving behind a child, and that was so impossible. Let me just tell you one story from the end was that we were shopping. I had this really awful boyfriend. I hope he's not listening right now, but I won't.
Maybe
name
I hope names. He is. I don't know.
Yeah, I do too. I secretly do. That's the Christian way. But anyway, I was buying this short little cute dress because that's what he liked in a girl, whereas I usually dress like John Goodman. And I was with Pammy. It was about 6 weeks before she died, and she was in a wheelchair. And had a wig on, and I went in and I put this little tight dress on, and I came out and I said to her, "Do you think my hips look big in this dress?" And she looked at me and she said, "Annie, you don't have that kind of time." Mm-hmm. And it was like standing next to a Buddhist gong. I mean, I got it in that mm-hmm. moment, mm-hmm. and my life changed. And that was, you know, 33 years ago.
Yeah. You know, my wife read operating instructions when she was pregnant with our first baby, she told me this morning, and just loved it, thought it was incredible kind of preparation for life, a new phase of life. I wanted to ask you, you know, I mean, you're a lifelong Bay Area resident pretty much, and I want to know a place in our region that you really hold sacred or really loved, like one individual spot.
Well, one individual place. It's not a spot, but it's Mount Tamalpais.
Oh, yeah.
I was born and raised in Tiburon when it was still a railroad town and the trains still ran. And we were up on the mountain on those trails hiking with my dad, who was a bird watcher. I remember being 4 and 5, you know, and we always brought a chub of salami. And
that's like a technical term, right? That's the actual.
The actual. And it came in paper, remember? Oh, you're young. I know you're young, but it used to peel the paper off. And then all men at the time had both handkerchiefs and pocket knives. And you cut the salami with the pocket knife, and then you spat into the handkerchief and or the Kleenex, and then wiped your children up with it. That was the way it was done in the 50s and 60s, was that your parents were continually spitting into bits of cloth or tissue and wiping up the mess you'd made.
You know, my dad had a handkerchief for like the first, I don't know, it must have been the first 35 years of my life. He probably still has a handkerchief in his back pocket right now. What happened? You know, it's one thing I love about Mount Tam is, you know, from the East Bay, you kind of see it kind of as just a line, you know, it's just sort of a sloping shoulder of a mountain. But then when you go over to Mount Tam, you realize it's kind of more than one thing, right? I mean, you get up close and suddenly it's valleys and hills, and it's more than just that one line you see from the East Bay.
Oh, it's majestic. And the coastal Miwok worshipped it. It's the first thing, one of the first things we ever learn as a child in Northern California is about the coastal Miwok. Mm-hmm. And we walk on the ground where they walked on the old trails. And all of a sudden you come up to, and you can see the entire Pacific Ocean, and you can see, you can almost see to Japan. I think I said in somehow that there's trails where you can see all the way to Tokyo, because it feels like that. It's so big. And then there's these trails that are so intimate. And then you step into glades of redwoods and eucalyptus and brush, and there's glades, and you're just completely surrounded and held by these trees and by the turpentine scent of the eucalyptus and the redwoods that stand thousands of feet tall like soldiers and just so straight and,
I know. Maybe I smash my face trail running on Mount Tam, and maybe I'll think of it as an offering to the mountain.
An offering to the mountain gods. Well, I see it every morning when I step out of the house. I see the sleeping maiden. I see the northern face and the sleeping maiden. And every single day, I'm reminded of all the beauty in the world.
Yeah. We're talking with the author Anne Lamott about her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. You heard the writing prompt. What's a place that makes you feel love and why? But of course, you can also call us 866-733-6786 and tell us, you know, what Anne Lamott works speak to you. This new work, and it's all about all kinds of love. Mm-hmm. What kind of inspired you to write it, knowing it'd be published kind of near your 70th birthday? Was that part of it?
I was traveling around for the last book for Dusk Night Dawn, and it's about hope and revival and courage in the face of how scary the world has become. You know, the UN climate reports were about 4 years ago where they said we had 12 years to turn it around before there was absolutely catastrophe globally. And I don't see that much has changed, you know, so we have 8 years left. And I was just so grief-struck on behalf of my son, Sam, and my grandchild, Jax, and about the future they hold. And so I started writing a bunch of pieces that were about everything that had ever worked before, like community and nature and picking up that 200-pound phone and calling someone and sharing the scare, the terror that you feel, or the grief or bad self-esteem you feel or whatever, and sharing it in the sacred paths that we're on in the ocean and anything that had ever worked before to heal or to give us confidence when things were scary, that would almost certainly work again, no matter what their future is. And I wanted to leave this behind for them when I'm gone. And it turned out that every single piece I wrote had somehow or other to do with love. All of a sudden, I was writing a book on love. And of course, you know, my husband, Neil Allen, has written a book on the inner critic called Better Days. And as soon as my inner critic, and the inner critic keeps you alive, right? It when you're a child, it keeps you from running out into the street or swimming out too far. But when I'm very good with traffic safety here in my very late 60s, and with I don't swim out past the breakers, but the inner critic surfaces to say, oh, you have got to be kidding. You are not going to write a book on love. What is the East Coast literati going to do? Is there any word more overused than love? Please. But Neil, I've been with him 7.5 years. He said, oh, that's just your inner critic. Just tell the stories you want to tell. It'll be fine. So I hope it is. You've probably read it more recently than I have, because I don't read it once it's published. And I got copies a few months ago. But anyway, that's how it came to be, was that I wanted to leave it for my family when I'm gone. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you grew up in Marin in a kind of literary world to some extent. I mean, do you think that taught you anything about love, or was it almost more like a counterexample to the kind of love that you...
I love that question. Well, I grew up, if you've read somehow or probably anything I've written, I grew up with hardcore atheist intellectuals. Mm-hmm. My dad, Kenneth, was a writer also. And I grew up, we all worshiped the New York Times. I mean, I think there was a little golden calf of the New York Times on the table every morning before breakfast, and we bowed down.
I don't think that was in the book, Anne.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't? Oh, okay. But there, you know, there's a lot of alcoholism in my family and black belt codependence. My mother's from Liverpool. And no matter what, you didn't cry and you weren't angry. And my parents couldn't stand each other. But they never raised their voices. It was like a Harold Pinter play, you know, around my house. And so I grew up very worried and sad and thinking that it was my responsibility to help them feel better about their lives. And so love was very fraught for me.
Oh. Anne Lamott talking about her life in Marin, early life. Her new book is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. We'll take some of your calls after the break. Is there a place or an activity that makes you feel love? You can email us forum@kqed.org or give us a call. 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. More with Anne Lamott right after the break. That path is for your steps alone. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Anne Lamott about her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love, publishes today. Her 70th birthday is tomorrow. We get her on the last day of her 60s here. And so, you know, in this book, you've kind of refracted different kinds of love, showing how love has kind of been the glue and meaning for your life. Given your childhood and given that it was really difficult, and as you said, your parents couldn't stand each other, when did you think you first experienced the kind of love that's really centered your life these past couple decades?
Well, first of all, my parents were really pretty incredible. They loved us. They just didn't love each other. So we had a very convoluted sense of what love actually meant. But I got sober almost 38 years ago. And at that point, I went from having a God who thought that I was extremely disappointing to beginning to experience some kind of presence of love around me, and certainly in the people that were helping me get sober and stay sober. Just that in that beautiful generosity of time and spirit and experience. And I think that was when the plates of the earth shifted underneath me. I'd already converted. I was going to this little church in Marin City called St. Andrew. And so I already had this sort of spiritual love going on. I'd always had a belief in God, but I had a little church by then. But until I got sober, I just, it was pretty, it was, there was a reason I had very bad self-esteem, let's say. I was doing really bizarre and bad, unesteemable things with I was having tiny boundaries with men, among other issues. Mm-hmm. But so around then, I started to learn what community love looked like. It looked like these people getting out of themselves to become a person for others, i.e. me. Mm-hmm. And that blew my mind. And they started teaching me that the blessing was to watch other people heal. And so that when I even had like 6 months sober, there were people there were 6 days who thought that I was, you know, the Sphinx, because I knew certain very small things about how to stay sober for a day. There was a guy who said to me that at the end of his drinking, he was deteriorating faster than he could lower his standards.
Oh.
Oh, God. And that was so true for me. And the way he said it was so loving, like that he just got me. He grokked me. He knew what it was like for me. And what he was saying was, it's not going to always be like this. That one day at a time, you are going to start to care for yourself. You're going to start to experience, like there's a whole chapter in Somehow about the great line of William Blake's where he says, we are here to learn to endure the beams of love. And I had always been like the flight attendant for my family, trying to save and fix and rescue my parents and try to help keep their marriage afloat and get my dad to come home every day. And so I was pretty exhausted. I had migraines till I was 18 very frequently from the stress of it all. And so I was learning little by little what love looked like, where you didn't have to earn it, where your value didn't come from doing things that other people thought was great, or doing things for which you got more and more attention and acclaim. I was learning that I was lovable and deserving of love just because I'm a regular old human being. And it's hard here that this side of eternity has not been a good match for somebody as anxious and shy and you know, self-conscious as I am. Mm-hmm.
I also do like, while those things may be true, you did rewrite the William Blake line.
I did.
From bear to endure. You're like, sorry, the meter's a little off, William.
Right.
I did want to ask you about community. One of our listeners writes in to say, the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma has always been love. The community there became my family, and I wouldn't be here today without their support. I'm a passionate community builder now as an adult because of that unconditional love and access to a safe space. Question for you, kind of coming out of this, how do you think people go wrong when they go to build community? Because it does seem like there's a lot of failed community building efforts out there in the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a whole chapter really on how to join a community because, I would never leave my house again, really. You can ask my husband. I would sit on the couch with the animals and read like the New Yorker and then binge on Below Deck, left to my own devices. But you can't really become a fully human without a community is the way that I understand it. And Martin Luther King talked a lot about the beloved community and that's where the soul entered. That's where the nourishment for the soul is in being a person for others and letting them include you and love you and get you a cup of tea when you feel shaken or whatever. But it's really hard to do. And so there's kind of an instruction manual in Somehow for what you do. And I can give you the short form right now. Is what you do is you look for and listen for the communities of people in your own community in the Bay Area, say, that have something that you really want. You want to really be plugged into a political organization that is not just, you know, words, but that is getting a lot done, that is that is registering people, that is funding, that is having benefits, that is, or you want to mentor people, but you really don't even know where to start, or you are a bird watcher, or you have seen people doing ecstatic dancing on the lawn Saturday mornings, or you have, you know, whatever. And so this is what you have to do. You find out when they meet, and then you show up, and the bad voice, the inner critic, will say, these people are nuts, or conversely, what Groucho Marx always said, that he wouldn't want to belong to a group that would have him. And you don't listen to them, and you step through the door, and awful, horribly, somebody may come over.
And perceive you.
God, it's like a total nightmare. Yeah, and then you can't bolt. And they come over and they say, oh, hi, I'm Ed. How are you? What's your name? Oh, I am Annie. And they go, I'm so glad you're here. Let me show you around. And then you can't get out. I mean, it's just the worst thing that could happen. And then you stay and you listen. And I said, and somehow, that 80% of it might just be dreck or rhetoric or spiritual hoo-ha or whatever, but the 20% will save you. Mm. You're in it for the 20%. Mm. And so then you're seeing that they're registering voters, or that they're helping the elderly, or they're in a folk dance, or in a square dancing, God, in the 50s and 60s, square dancing, it was like church, and they're doing it. And so the miracle is you go back a second time, and then people come up, or they bring you water, and they say, hey, come over here, someone made cookies, or I remember you from last week, and you just keep saying hello, and a lot of miracles and a lot of new life begins with saying hello.
Let's bring in Arlene in Berkeley. Welcome, Arlene.
Hi. It just happens one of my happy places happened, Rio Brings Me Love and Community, through a group called Outdoors Unlimited. And it was part of UCSF in the 80s and 90s, and I'm not quite sure when they closed. But it was community because you'd have these group meetings, and then you'd come together and take trips, like go skiing and, mm-hmm. and go out. I learned how to windsurf, ski, kayak, sail, all through this program. And one day we went out to Bolinas, and we went down this steep hill by a tennis court, climbed over this house that had been wiped away by the ocean, dropped our boards down from the foundation, and got on the beach there. And I just got lucky and did a beach start without trying. They're like, go try while we set up. I jumped on the board and just started sailing without one fall, and thought I'd chase this ship I saw. And when I realized that wasn't going to happen, the wind picked up, and I backbend so far that my hair hit the water. And I looked up, and the seagulls were flying with me, and the seals were swimming along. And it was just like an incredible moment. My weight and the wind were working, you know, because I didn't have the power to hold that kind of wind in the sail. But it all worked together that moment, and just sailed along, and it was just, yeah. So like,
Arlene, yeah, in love with the world in that kind of moment. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Hey, thanks so much for sharing that moment with us, Arlene. I mean, I know Bolinas is one of your special places too, Anne, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, I grew up there. My grandparents had bought a one-room cabin for $2,000 on Duxbury Reef. And so that's where we always went as a family, because we never had any money to go anywhere. So we always just went out to this little cabin. It was literally heaven for me, for any child, yeah.
Another little place reflection, Ed writes in to say, I feel love at the small beach revealed at very low tide magic moments at the mouth of Marin County's Elephant Rock Cave, not far from Dillon Beach. It is where I learned how to teach children to love and respect the deep beauty of the sea and the shore. And of course, in this book, one of the most beautiful moments is when you go with your father near the end of his life out into a minus tide way out. And you have this like moment of reflection. And one of the things you say in the book is, you know, that there's a moment there where you're just intensely alive, and it's not totally clear why. Like, what do you make of why sometimes we do experience that kind of peak moment in our lives?
Well, I think sometimes we're accidentally breathing really deeply again. It could be the ocean spray, and it could be that it's almost like the movement of grace, and it spritzes you like a plant mister, and it wakes you up, and you take a deep, you go, and you're wide awake, and you're fully alive for a few minutes here and there. It's such a beautiful experience. And so, yeah, the piece is about both being at Agate Beach at a minus tide with my dad, and then a friend, Karen Carlson, who died last year, way younger than I was, who just lived for these minus tides because they only come a few times a year. It's like I'm in New York City now, and everybody is just still talking about the eclipse yesterday, but there's and I wrote in Traveling Mercies about a lunar eclipse that had the same kind of attention worldwide. I mean, just stunning, you know, God totally showing off, or life, or astronomy just totally showing off every so often like it does. But something spritzes you and you're just fully there the way you wish you could be all the time, and that you just aren't, because life is just so lifey some days, and we have our to-do lists, and we really absolutely have to remember to pick up graph paper on the way home, and blah, blah, blah. You know, with my writing students who are, I just tell them, if you want to be a writer when you grow up, I want you to cross two things off your to-do list and instead just scribble for like 10 minutes a memory that you have. Write about your earliest memory of holidays, of Christmas, your first birth. You know, just do less. And that, if you can just do less, you're going to see more and feel more, and you're going to have those moments. They're like holy moments when you kind of gasp awake again, and you notice that all around you is this theater. It's either theater of this absurd, or it is just so pretty. You know, I talk a lot, and I know I wrote again and somehow, but in a lot of my books, about looking up, like you're in that mental state of fixation with your own problems and your own character defects and the 10 people you're still angry at, and you're in this hole, and if you step outside and you look up, it's going to reset your whole day. You know, you don't look up and go, oh my God, it's kind of a medium moon tonight. You look out, or the stars are kind of medium. They're
mid.
Mid okay. But my pastor years ago told me you can trap bees in the bottom of mason jars without a lid because they don't look up. They just walk along on the bottom of the glass, bumping into the walls kind of bitterly. And all they have to do to find freedom is to look up. And so there's many ways that you can train yourself to be here for the one short precious life you have. You'll often see me, if you were here, you would see me now, but I often wear a red rubber band loosely around my wrist because you can gently snap it and snap your way back into the presence because you get a breath. You snap it gently and you go, you do an intake of air, and you're kind of back, and it's...
What
it's,
about moments, though, where that you almost don't want to be, right? Because there's, like, you have your camellia plant, which is outside your window. You talk about in the book, the beautiful thing. I know I can picture it absolutely exactly. And obviously the quality of attention that you've provided to that plant and the way that you think and look at it all the time. It's a beautiful description. But you also, in one section of the book, you're feeling bad about yourself and refuse to look at the beauty embodied in the camellia.
Yeah. Well, it's like I'm going to punish it by not looking at it. I'm going to walk right past it because I'm too cranky. But, you know, most of life is just so hard here sometimes. And I just wish that everything were organized better. And if I were God's West Coast representative, I would have all the sad things in one silver part of the silverware drawer where the knives are. And I would have all the happy things where the big forks are. And all these things, like this camellia bush in full bloom, I would have in the salad forks. But it's life is just so lifey and so mixed grill. And there's so, you have blessings upon blessings upon blessings. And you've got, well, I wasn't going to name names, but say you've got Trump, you've got MAGA, you've got the climate, you've got the catastrophe of the impending climate catastrophes all over that are here now. And it's so hard. And everywhere I go, when I'm reading one of my books, I'm reading about how do we feel hope? Well, you feel hope by bringing hope to somebody. If you want to have loving and hopeful feelings, you do loving, hopeful things. You call your aunt, who's very lonely and very weird, and you stay on the phone with her even when she goes off on another tangent that makes you just want to run screaming for your cute little life. You stay on the phone because she's lonely, and you give her hope, and then hope exists again in the community, right? And everywhere I go with my little hopey books, people feel very scared. People feel very sad, and they feel without hope. And that was what Somehow was about. It was about how my son and grandson can find hope and operating instructions after I'm gone. The community, nature, Mount Tam, quiet, whatever. And so, I'm so sorry. I spaced out. I forgot the question.
No, that was a great.
Question. Yeah.
Well, let's get to one listener wants to write in and say, I moved to Marin while going through a divorce around 1997. This is a good story about you, Anne.
Okay.
One day I ventured out of what had become my sad drinking lair to a garage sale. There, I found a very cool brown suede jacket which reeked of smoke. A woman approached me with such kind eyes and asked me to make an offer. Sniffing the jacket, I said, $20? The kind gal beamed and said, sold. Just then, another woman hurried over and said, Annie, what? Then turned to me and said, do you know who this is? I didn't know that it was Anne Lamott. Later, her writing helped me rebuild my life. I have so much gratitude for Anne Lamott, who has been a blessing for me.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
That's
you for
so
that
sweet.
Reflection, yeah. Mike. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking with Anne Lamott about her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love. We're also playing some songs that are mentioned throughout the book or that were suggested to us by the words of the book. Anne's going to be at City Arts and Lectures this Saturday, April 13th. Also happens to be my birthday, 7:30 p.m.
Oh, my God.
I know. We're both Aries. What can you say? We would love to hear from you. What Anne Lamott works speak to you? Or is there a place or an activity that makes you feel love? You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We'll be back with more with Anne Lamott right after the break. On a dark street, hide from the people we meet. You see, we're still in love. We've got to be discreet, 'cause we're loving on borrowed time. Welcome back to Forum. We're talking with Anne Lamott about her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love, and, you know, life itself. When that William Bell song came on Love and Unborrowed Time, I was like, oh man, we should really just bring that back up. It's so good. But let's bring in another call. Let's bring in Sarah in Benicia. Welcome.
Hi Anne.
Hi.
Good morning. So when you say look up, you know, the first thing that I thought of is that when people would just stop looking at their phone, whatever that they're doing, when they're walking, driving. And it's just sad that there's so much beauty around us, especially right now, you know, in spring, everything is blooming and the birds are singing. And so when you said that, that was the first thing that came to my mind.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's true. You know, Sarah, I think, Sarah, did you also want to say something about the word community as well? Oh, I think we lost you. Oh, no, there you are.
I feel like the word community is being overused or misused because, and I was thinking if you can help me to find another word other than community, because when I hear the word community, I kind of like, I dismiss it immediately because in my experience, some of the communities I've been in have been quite exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, my race or my income status.
That's a really, it's a really interesting point, Sarah, right? Because there's kind of like how some groups kind of generate in-group feeling, right, is to exclude other people. Thanks for bringing that up, Sarah. I really appreciate that.
I love the word gatherings, and because gatherings can be small and they can also be huge. They can be at the soccer field at Golden Gate Park where I grew up. I love the word gatherings. I don't have a problem with community. My son, I have to plug this, has a writing community with 500 writers of every different stage in the Bay Area called thewritinggroup.com. And it is a community of people who love to write, some of whom are starting out, some of whom are published, and they're all really there for each other. They read each other's stuff, they give each other prompts, they edit, they form small communities of four or five people, and there's some that are 100 that breathe down each other's neck and insist that everybody in the group have 7 more pages finished by Monday. And in that way, they're doing something that the people at a writing room could not do alone. There's so much you can't do alone. I wish you could. You can't sing harmony alone, you know, and you see yourself through your own bad self-esteem eyes or grandiosity if you're not careful. And when you are in a community or a gathering, it's like it holds up a mirror of how they see you, which is that they think you're great. They're really glad that you came today, you know? But, I really don't think I belong to any exclusive communities, but so I've been really blessed. I mean, I'm in recovery. I go to this funny little church you're all welcome to come to Sunday mornings at 11 in Marin City or online, St. Andrew Prez. And
I wanted to ask you about that because I do, you know, Marin has experienced a ton of changes while you've lived there. You know, it's become one of the hotbeds of wealth, like in the entire world, really globally.
Yeah.
And also Marin City is kind of the flip side of that. And how have you tried to make sense of building a community that can reach across, you know, this kind of chasm of inequality?
It's just so hard. I mean, there are 6 churches in Marin City in a community of 2,000. Mostly people of color live there now. But we are a left-wing, progressive, community-based. All of the churches are doing this very profound work in the community. They've gotten clinics started. And you can't start a clinic. A church can't start a community clinic. But 6 of them can, you know. And you can't start one church can't start a mentoring or a... my mind just went blank. But the school before kindergarten... One church can't do that. In the county, most of the money goes to the fancier schools, but 6 churches working together can. 6 churches working together, I mean, had a massive Black Lives Matter presence and crossing over into just over the highway into Sausalito and then all over parts of Marin with movements and marches and rallies and music and the whole thing. And so that's been... It's just exhilarating to watch other people start to do really well. I think that's why I've just never left the church, and I'm really active in this community of recovery, and I'm just really active in my town because it's so wonderful to get out of your own, you know, ticker tape, pinball machine brain and hook into something really big that is changing the world, that is hooking into goodness and activism and making the world a better place. And, you know, all those years in the women's movement in the mid-70s when we were talking about planting trees for generations that hadn't been born yet, you know? And so...
You know, one other, it's really a theme that kind of shows up in this book, and I think in part because it's just a theme in Bay Area life is, you know, how many people don't have homes, who kind of made their lives kind of stitched in the margins of society, sleeping outside. I mean, how do you, in this book, how do you try to reckon with, you know, feeling called to work with people who find themselves homeless and at the same time, again, trying to like bridge a pretty big gulf?
Yeah, well, the story, this first full story in Somehow is about these purple bags filled with things like toothpaste and body wash and socks and caps for cold weather that my church, St. Andrew, put together to give to the unhoused in Marin County. And so the story is about taking a few of them to give out one day and kind of the extreme embarrassment I found in giving them to people who were sort of worried when this nice Christian lady with dreadlocks came over and sat next to them on the bench where they were smoking and tried to get them to take one of these bags of body wash and dental floss and toothpastes. And so, but you know, before I turned on Woody Allen, he used to say that 90% of life was just, 80% of life was just showing up. And so I kept showing up and I had these really touching, funny experiences giving away the, I call them the purple bags of love that my church gives out every week. And if you want to get some to give away to the homeless, just show up on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And, but God, the love of, there is one unhoused man in my town named Tom, and sharing this bag with him, he just loves me, and I'm not sure why. He just loves me, and we have something that every single thing about our lives is the opposite of each other's. But, you know, there's just one person. There's humankind, and there's one heart. And it is a very, very deeply sad heart a lot of the time. The people that I know, the people that I live in Marin with, they have had sorrow and losses and tragedies that are just, you know, end of the world, like anvils dropped on them and their families. But we stick together and we see each other and we look each other in the eye and we say, I'm glad to see you. Are you okay today? Can I get you a cup of tea? You know, we stand, you do, Mother Teresa once said something I love so much. She said, none of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. And so I teach my Sunday school kids that when you're in line, you're in the express line at the grocery store, and there was somebody in front of you who was so old, and they brought their coupons in the express line, which to me is like on beyond zebra. It's like, no. And what you do is you look them in the eye and you say, hi, how are you? I'm glad to see you. I love your hat. You know, or can I, is your dog friendly? Can I pet your dog? And that's love, and that's bringing love.
Man, they brought
love.
Their dog and their coupons in
they
the express
their
line.
Dog I mean, and come their on. Coupons, the whole situation, the whole sitch. And you look him at you, you know, maybe no one else told him that. And with unhoused people, no one is saying to them that they're glad to see him that day. And so you say, hey, how are you doing? I'm glad to see you.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Yeah. Let's bring in Susan in Palo Alto. Hi, Susan. Welcome. No. All right, Susan. So sorry. Hopefully we'll get you back. Let's bring in Barbara in San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi, Barbara.
Yes. My favorite place, now that I think about it, but it's changed, is the Hindu community in Colma. I used to go there on my own and enjoy the location. They had a herd of about 100 exotic white deer there at the time.
Mm-hmm, I remember.
That sounds
thank
lovely.
You.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. We also have some folks who want to talk about some of your other books. You know, one listener writes in to say, you know, I want to thank Anne for her book, Operating Instructions. I happened upon it on my Kindle from the Oakland Public Library while breastfeeding my infant son in the middle of the night 6 years ago. Although I don't remember much from those early days, I'm getting teary-eyed right now thinking about how you wrote about the joy and sorrow and hope and fear of being a new parent. Thank you for being my late-night companion in those early days. Also, a lot of love coming in for your book, Plan B, as well. Roz writes, I picked up Plan B randomly when my brother was in the hospital, and it helped me stay sane. Mm-hmm. Last one here, listener writes, this morning I was feeling the stress of my daily routine. Then there was Anne's voice, the familiar voice of the wisdom to live as fully as we can, even when we don't think we can. My beloved mother and I read each of your books together. We would go to Kepler's Books in Menlo Park, buy your latest book together, and enjoy it together. underlining, turning pages. Those books are all in my den on my bookcase, and I return to them regularly. Hearing your voice brings my precious mama close to me this morning and reminds me of my deep desire to really live in this one precious gift of a life that I have
thank
now.
You. That's so sweet, yeah.
What an amazing thing to be able to do for people. And one thing that I have wondered about this, just in the way you presented it somehow, do you ever think that being a writer, you know, kind of observing the way that writers observe, sharing the way that writers share, is at odds with your conception of love? Like, is there something fundamentally at odds between the acts of publishing about your experiences and closest friends and kind of, is there anything at odds there for you?
Well, yeah, there's my very small galaxy where I talk to a few people very intimately. It's like in the first, in the bullseye of my life, there's just me and the kitty and God and who I was when I was a little kid. And there, it's just a very cozy, intimate place. And then the one bullseye out, there's a few, like three friends and my husband. And then two bullseyes out, there's where I would talk to people pretty confidently about stuff that's very sad or embarrassing or painful and or weird. And then on the next bullseye out is where I communicate that to the public, because by then, three or four bullseye rings out, I know that it's universal. And so in somehow, when I write about stuff that was really painful or shaming, I know there's nothing that I don't think you personally mm-hmm. and people listening haven't experienced. It's just the details might be different. I write a lot about shame because I find that people have such shame about feeling shame. and the thing is that it is so human because we were raised that way. We were raised with the horrible, horrible value of perfectionism. I was raised not knowing that B+ was a good grade. I was raised because I had weird hair and I looked so different being bullied for that. And doing the deep dive into shame has really given me myself back, because at first you pretend you don't have. Let me tell you something. I have a great friend. He's like my wife, named Father Tom Weston. He's who famously said that you can tell you created God in your own image because he hates all the same people you do. But 30 some years ago, he said to me, this is the way of life for American adults. First of all, you must not have anything wrong with you or different about you. You must, in all circumstances, be able to pass. Okay, the second thing is if you have something wrong with you or different about you, you just have to correct it as quickly as possible. The third rule is that if you can't correct it or fix it, you should just pretend you have. Just it's not a big deal anymore, that silly old thing. And the fourth thing is that if you can't even pretend to have that it's not an issue anymore, you should just not show up. Because it's just so painful for the rest of us when you do. And the fifth thing is that if you're going to insist on the right to show up, you should have the decency to be ashamed. Wow. Right? Yeah. Right? And that's what every writer is about. That's what I talk about at a writing room, is the first thing you get over is the shame, because your work is not going to be good. You are going to have to write terrible first drafts. And I do too with every book I've written. And then you write an ever so slightly better second draft. But you're going to still have shame, because at the end of the second draft, you're going to not be able to believe how much work there still is to do. And so I write about that a lot. And it's such a dark, shadowy corner of our lives that when one of us writers or even a best friend will just shine a little flashlight on that corner for you and say, you know what, I'm glad you can see it, but I want you to know it's exactly the same for me. I was there the other day, and what I did was I called you. What I did was I went for a walk. What I did was, you know, I picked up the 200-pound phone and I called my mentor, whatever. And because we're all in the same boat, anything you personally have felt, I have felt and been through. I'm older now. I'm of course still in my 60s, but tomorrow I'll be in my 70s, and I've had a lot more loss, I think, than you have. But otherwise, You know, mm-hmm. this is what the what it means to be a human here. Jared Manley Hopkins said that the glory of God is the human fully alive. And to be fully alive is a very scary thing. You know, we were not raised to be fully alive. My great friend Duncan Trussell says when you first meet him, you're meeting his bodyguard. And that's, you know, true, I think, for most of the people I know, that you meet them and they're telling you who they present as. They're like the curated lives such as people present on Facebook. And so mm-hmm. to start to agree to let the bodyguard go off to the library for an hour while you just sit with somebody and get to know them a little better, or to even get to know yourself a little better, is just magic. And I think maybe it takes getting older to agree to do that, because you really want to be here for this short, precious life.
Mm. Julie writes in to say, I used to see this is a place of love. My grandmother's kitchen is a place of love, steamy and wrapped in aromas that meant she was working with her love language. Then I saw my mother's hands as a place of love, where she was packing for another move or unpacking upon arrival, always putting our home in place, no matter where the military sent us. When it was my turn to move away, I lost my grandmother's kitchen, my mother's hands. Now I find love in my husband's eyes and his reassuring voice and my children's entire beings. When I look at them, I love them, but I fear loss at the same time. I wonder how I'll make it when my son leaves for college next year. I've struggled with loss and abandonment for so long that I apply those filters to too many interactions. Hopefully, with each change in my life, I'll find a new place to believe that love is possible and see it there. We have been talking with Anne Lamott about her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love. It's going to be at City Arts and Lectures this Saturday, April 13th. Anne Lamott, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. I loved every minute here. I love KQED.
Oh, hey, thank you so much, Anne. The book is beautiful. Really, I think your readers are going to love it. So, Somehow, Thoughts on Love by Anne Lamott, on sale today. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
The British just couldn't see. Yeah, yeah. Everybody needs love, and to watch the twinkling stars above, it makes a boy and girl, yeah, say they feel so fine now.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.